Sounds good. Okay, well, it's 6:01 here, Thursday evening, May 20th, 2021. I'm going to call the Administrative Control Board meeting for the Mountain Regional Water Special Service District to order. And I need to read this determination regarding electronic meetings without an anchor location. And we've made this written determination regarding public meetings during COVID-19. And we can't conduct board meetings with an anchor location that's physically accessible for members of the public to attend in person. If we do that, it's presented a substantial risk to the health and safety. And so, you know, we've determined certain facts and that we're going to, we've demonstrated the ability to effectively conduct these public meetings electronically, and reading this written determination into the minutes as required by the Open Meetings Act. So, do we have any public input tonight? I don't think so. Okay. For item 3, we have the 2020 audit presentation. Dana? You guys.
All right.
Take it away.
Steve, did you want to, are you getting the info? Yes, there it is. Great. Did you want to kind of, yeah, are you going to introduce it a little, or do you want me to just kind of start, or what would you prefer?
You can go ahead and just kind of start. That's fine.
Okay. All right. Well, so Steve's put up on the screen the financial statements and other information, but basically the financial statement report for 2020. I was just going to kind of go through a few high points. One of the first things I thought was really cool that, well, cool. I mean, Steve, if you want to go to page 11 of the PDF, it's the last page of the transmittal letter.
Okay.
I thought it was very interesting where you guys added in. There's a lot of language that we see in there typically every year talking about different things, your rates, your, you know, different things that you've seen. But this year, you added in what your comments are, your struggling for my words, as mentioned, I'm getting old. The drought, the approach to the drought, and I just thought that was really interesting, well done. It was interesting to read, and I just wanted to point out that that is kind of new in there for this year, because obviously we're in a little bit of a mess. Like, I'm sure you guys are by far more informed than I was, but I was even just reading a little article about where pine view's at already at the end of May. It's already so low, and it's just kind of interesting. So I just wanted to point out that that is something that's a little bit new. We haven't had it in the past in this particular part of the financial statements. The next page, Steve, if you want to scroll down, the next page is actually our report on the financial statements. So all that prior, the prior pages are supplemental information. We don't really audit it. It's just what's called a transmittal letter. So it's a kind of a little bit extra. It's not required by, for a basic set of financial statements under generally accepted accounting principles. But then we come to our report, and in this report, it's about 3 pages long, but we basically are just saying that the financial statements, based on our audit, we concluded that they were, that they are presented in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And so that's all good. There's nothing we need to call out. There's no extra language in here that would indicate there's any kind of problem or anything like that. And so, so that's all really good. It references a couple of other reports that we will go through later tonight that discuss work we did on compliance and internal controls as other reporting required by government auditing standards. That's some additional work we do when we're working on a government audit, and we'll go over the report that we issue in connection with that. So basically, that's all I really have on that. The next pages, the next 14 or so pages are what is called management's discussion and analysis. And I know you've all seen this before, and I know Karen's done a really detailed review of it. It's largely just summarizing the information that's in the financial statements and provide a little narrative about it. I'm not going to necessarily go over a lot of that unless, Steve, you want me to call out anything.
No, I think the board's pretty aware of how the year ended from some reports we've given earlier. So they know it was a good year, let's say, revenue-wise.
And yeah. So. Okay. Plus, I always feel like I'm always coming to the party really late, so this is all really old information for you guys. But so we could just skip to the next couple things I wanted to just go to, Steve. If you want to go to page 31, is just basically the balance sheet. We call it a statement of net position. And I was just going to point out, like, say, you've already basically gone over this stuff, but basically I wanted to mention that this is really comparable to last year. There aren't any big, massive fluctuations. The assets are largely, in total, really similar. One thing I was going to point out, you can see on here, kind of in the middle of the page, there's a current portion of restricted cash and cash equivalents and a non-current portion of restricted cash and cash equivalents. I just kind of want to call that out because that's obviously money that you aren't able to just use for general operations. We'll look at a footnote that kind of outlines what all those are related to too. But so sometimes I just like to point it out so that boards don't think, oh, we've got all this money, when really like $6 million is actually restricted for use. Same thing on the next page. The liabilities, again, it's super comparable to last year. You know, 2019, you have the big refunding and the issuance of the 2019 bonds. So there's quite a lot of activity as far as liabilities go. But for 2020, there really wasn't that much. So I would just kind of basically point that out and move on. We could go to the next page is the income statement. And like Steve said, you're already well aware you had good revenues for the year. Just based on the kind of the growth, the warmer spring, warmer summer, kind of earlier spring. So you, obviously we've got higher revenues 2020 compared to 2019. Expenses went up a bit, and we comment about this a little bit in the MD&A, and I'm sure you're all aware, but that was the first year of the $200,000 regionalization fee that gets paid to Weber Basin, so that was one increase. And there was also a little bit more of the carbon and membranes that were installed during the year, so that was part of the increase in expenses as well. Otherwise, really not that much to point out unless there are questions. I'll pause, and if anybody wants to run anything by me or bring up some questions, that's great. Usually it's like, okay. Steve, do you want to go to page 46 of the PDF? Is note 4 that talks about the restricted assets. I was just gonna, this just summarizes the amounts that we have set aside that aren't available for day-to-day operations. Yeah, right there. So it just outlines what they're for, different accounts that are mostly it's related to bonds and or impact fees. And so you've got your different amounts set aside as required under the bond covenants, and then the impact fee reserves that you've collected over the years. And there's some supplemental information at the back of the report that kind of that explains even more about the impact fees. So I just wanted to mention that so you can see where those, what all those restricted funds are for, how they're set aside. A couple pages down, page 49 is just another note that's kind of important from a standpoint of just, I don't know, just to be aware, but it shows the activity in your long-term obligations. And again, I've already mentioned it, but 2019 had the big, huge increase in bonds payable for the 2019 bonds and the refunding and everything. So it had a corresponding decrease as well. But there was a lot of activity last year, and this year, all there really is normal payments on the bonds. So it was pretty uneventful, COVID notwithstanding. another thing kind of related to your debt. Steve, if you want to go to page 57, we talk about, there's a footnote in here called pledged revenues, and it just explains that revenues, basically all your net revenue from impact fees, from user fees, you know, sale of water, 58.85 million of that is pledged to cover these bonds. And basically where that comes from are, it's the principal and interest requirements on all of the bonds that are outstanding. And we just, it's a required disclosure, and it's important to understand that, you know, for a user of the financial statements to understand that the revenues aren't coming in just as a free for all. There's a lot of commitment there in having this debt and what the revenues are used for. So I just kind of wanted to point out that footnote as well. There are, if you want to go to page 62, Steve, it's part of the footnotes on the pension. The pension footnotes go on for approximately forever. right there. That's the one.
Go.
Yeah. Wait. Let's see. Yeah, page 51. So scroll up just a teeny bit. What I wanted to point out here is this shows what your employer contributions were for 2019 and 2020. 2020 is on top and 2019 is on the bottom. And you can see the actual contributions that are required under the URS are very, very similar year over year. And so we have these different financial statement components like the net pension liability and then the other related items, and they fluctuate so much from year to year. And that's all just based on kind of what's going on in the markets, what the actuaries are figuring out and such. But what I wanted to mainly point out is that despite those changes, year over year, your budget amounts don't get affected that much. Basically, you can kind of count on contributing about this much every year. And these other issues might be more of an issue, that the other adjustments, the net pension liability, they would be more of an issue if we were in a state where our pension wasn't as well funded as it is in Utah. So given that we are well funded, there's nothing to really significantly worry about or budget for in terms of funding these net pension liabilities. They're kind of an extra disclosure, kind of an extra animal that came to fruition when a bunch of states got really upside down with their pensions. And so I just kind of wanted to point this particular line item out so you can see that year over year, your cash flows related to it aren't that impacted. Kind of similarly, are there any questions at this point? No. Steve, did you want to add anything?
No, you're doing great. Thank you. This is working out.
I would say I don't have any other huge things to look at, except for I was thinking if you want to go to page 75 of the PDF, it's a supplemental schedule. Again, it's not required under government auditing or government generally accepted accounting principles. What are the other? But it's a schedule that shows what your cash flows have been like, and then also what that does as far as covering your debt service. I'm sure you're all well aware, but your debt, your bonds require, your net revenues, essentially your revenues minus your expenses, not including depreciation. They are supposed to be 1.25 times your debt service requirement. And as you can see on the schedule, the basic number there is 2.05. So your net revenues are 2.05 times your debt service. And so that's just fantastic. And then the lower schedule is if you add in the balance of your rate stabilization fund, it's even higher. And so I just wanted to point that out, that you're in compliance with those bond requirements and also basically well above it. So, you know, so far, so good. Keep up the good work. That was really all I had in mind to go over on the financials. Steve, if you want to jump in, if anybody has any questions, we could just fire away.
I think the board should just know what a pleasure you are to work with and how it really works out well. And we've really enjoyed the relationship and getting this all put together. So
Well, I would say the same, really. In fact, let's go to our next letter, and I'll bring that up. How's that?
Do you want the compliance or the government one?
Why don't we do the compliance ones first, and then we can finish up with the governmental one, the governance one.
Okay.
I really appreciate what you said, Steve, too. Thank you. So this packet, two or three letters. The first letter is what's called, we'll refer to it as a yellow book letter. It's a report written in compliance or in accordance with government auditing standards, and literally the book is yellow. Like back in the day when we had a book, it was yellow. So we call everybody in our world calls it yellow book. And basically what we're just saying is, for internal control purposes, for the purpose of the audit, we gained an understanding of your internal controls. We didn't test them to provide an opinion on them, but we gained an understanding to develop our audit tests and to also see if we would if we identified any material weaknesses, we would have reported them here. We didn't identify any deficiencies or material weaknesses. We didn't even have any management comments because you guys do such a fantastic job of addressing control issues and managing your, I know you have a small staff, but you do such a great job of segregating the duties and really having as tight of controls as you can have. There's never a guarantee that nothing will happen, but, in general, I would say everything looks very solid what you're doing. So otherwise we would have some comments here. The other part of this letter talks about compliance and other matters. And as a part of a yellow book audit, a government auditing standards audit, we do look at compliance issues. You know, one thing we do is we go through the state compliance, which that's in the next letter. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the state has us go through a bunch of legal requirements. We also look at things like our payroll tax deposits being made timely, you know, anything like that that we are aware of that could have a non-compliance, could have a financial impact too. And so we go through things like that. And again, we aren't issuing an opinion on compliance, but we also don't have any comments on compliance. We didn't find any non-compliance that we would need to report. So basically this letter is really good and boring, and that's good for you. The next letter is the report that gets issued based on our tests of the state compliance requirements. And like I say, the state auditor's office gives us an audit guide, and it has different accounting or let's go back to the compliance letter, Steve. I'm on the wrong one. Sorry. Does that go down one more page?
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, that's the one. So this is for the state. And you can see we tested different things in those areas that are bullet pointed there. One thing I was going to let you know is there are a section of these. I'm trying to think which ones they end in. The first three or four of the bullet points we're required to test every year, and then the latter part of them we're only required to test every 3 years. But this happened to be the three-year mark, and so we did more testing this year. And there are just various requirements we go through, and Steve and Lisa and Scott help us get the information we need to indicate whether or not you're in compliance with these things. And again, we didn't find any indication of non-compliance. We're not forming an opinion on this compliance, but we didn't find anything we would need to report. So again, that's all really good from the state standpoint. Okay, let's switch over to that other letter you're at, Steve, on the governance one. And this one is just a letter that we're required to issue to boards, basically those charged with governance. It's pretty boilerplate language, just kind of indicating some of our responsibilities. The first part is mentioning the significant accounting policies. There were no changes to them this year. They're all disclosed in the first note on the financial statements, that note A. We also talk about the accounting estimates. We mentioned that your depreciation is a huge estimate, and also the net pension liability. You guys don't put the net pension liability estimate together, but you are relying on the URS, and it is a big estimate. And so we're basically just indicating that's something that's just out there that is not hard and fast, basically. The next little bit on the second page talks about disclosures that are kind of sensitive or important, I guess. So note 4, we already talked about that restricted assets note. And 6 and 7 just have to do with your outstanding debt and that pledged revenues that we talked about as well. Then the rest of all this is pretty basic, that we didn't encounter any difficulties and or any disagreements. And in fact, kind of like Steve said, from our perspective, this audit is just heaven. Everybody is so great to work with, and we get information we need. Just super conscientious. Everything goes so well. I'm just totally grateful for it. Anyway, the rest of this, you know, there weren't any adjustments that we found that we needed to make as a result of the audit. All the adjustments that we did come up with were just things Steve was aware of. Steve or Lisa were both aware of, and we just kind of posted them. They're minimal. Otherwise, we would disclose them to you. Basically, just that there weren't any other findings or issues that we came up with. There was one thing that kind of off this letter, I was talking about with my partner, I think you've met him, Ian Robbins, a couple times. He's presented the financials to you, I know. He and I were talking about it. We just didn't know where to kind of bring it up. So we wanted to just verbally, and I'm sure you're all totally aware, but with the cost of construction right now and everything that's going on kind of in our economy and the supply chain and everything, we just wanted to point out that it might not be a bad idea to just revisit your capital facilities plan. There's nothing wrong with it. We didn't know where to put it in like a written kind of suggestion, just because there's nothing wrong with what has been reported on, what it was used for during 2020. But given that things are just escalating like crazy, it might be something to kind of address. Like I say, I'm sure you're all completely on it, but we just kind of wanted to point that out as we've watched things go nuts the last few months and stuff. So nothing earth-shattering, just kind of a little thought from us to you. So
we appreciate that, Dana. Thanks.
Yeah, like I say, I'm sure that you're all aware, and just maybe there might be a need to increase impact fees a little or something, just to kind of cope with some of this. It's just crazy what's going on, but in general, it seems like you guys have come through our COVID fest and all of that really well. So anyway, that's all I have. I feel like I've been gabbing.
You've done great. They get tired of hearing from me, so it's good that they could hear from you for a little while.
Well, I've got a lot. Short and sweet. So, anyway.
All right. Well, appreciate that, board. Do you have any questions before we let her go for the evening? Before we let Dana go?
No, Dana. Really nice work.
Thank you. Thank you for your help. I love your review of the financials. It's like, it's amazing to me how 3 or 4 of us can read these things and we still miss stuff. You know, it's so great what you did at the end. That was just awesome. So thank you.
Well, thanks again.
Hey, thank you.
I guess we'll go ahead and pay your invoice then.
Oh, okay. Hey, thanks a lot. It's really great to work with you guys. We're really grateful and appreciate you guys a lot.
Awesome. Thanks, Dana.
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, so is there any action here? Was this just to let the board know that it's been completed and have an update there? Okay.
Yes, you don't have to do any action. It's just to bring you up to speed, give you the report on it.
Yep, that we've met.
I guess if there had been things she'd found, there would maybe be action items, but since it's clean, we're good.
Okay.
Yeah, and Steve, now that it's done and final and been reviewed and presented to the board, we'll have to get it on our website and send it to the bondholders and generally to our Zions and Wells Fargo. So we'll get up to those folks.
Sounds good.
So have we done a projection to see what happens when in next year, when those series 2019A water revenue bonds come in, how it changes our debt service coverage ratio?
Between other things dropping off and that coming on, we end up with almost the exact same debt and interest payments for the year. The way they refinance it, they help smooth it a little bit for us. So there's a big payment on the 2012 bond this year that it finishes the 2012 bond, and then the 2019 kicks in more. So the total amount we'll be paying out is very similar this year, last year, this year, and the year going forward.
Great. Yeah, I got it. I remember that now, that we get the 2012s paid off. They go away next year, and then the 19s. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Item four, executive session.
We do. We don't need an executive session tonight, Mike.
Okay, very good. So five is the consent agenda. Were there any questions on the minutes? Did anybody have comments there?
No.
Okay, it doesn't sound like it. On the check register, I don't know, maybe we'll just go one by one. Ian, did you have any questions there?
Yeah, the credit to the Utah Olympic Park for $71K, is that complete at that point? Is that the
that is complete that finalizes at that, that point? That finalizes that. As you may recall, the total was about $160,000. They used up about $90,000 in usage over the months, and so that was the cash difference that we paid them before their year ended at the end of April.
Okay. And then I think we've talked about this before, but remind me, the Iron Mountain impact fee reimbursement.
That's the colony, so they're kind of like Promontory. As they pay impact fees, there's a portion of that we reimburse back to them.
Okay. And then there was a Nickerson pump charge early in the month on the 6th for like $6,900. Which pump was that we replaced? Do we know?
I think that was for one of the shallow wells, one of the PL wells. Brian, do you?
I believe it was for those wells, yes.
Over by the lost.
The shallow well. Yeah,
okay. Was that the Delco West parts charge as well? Was that associated with that work?
The Delco West parts was actually vacuum regulators for our chlorine maintenance, 12 of those. So, yeah, we didn't get a full description in there, but it's 12. They're called vacuum regulators. And Brian says they manage our chlorine. Is that correct, Brian, or something?
Yeah, they're just chlorine parts for our numerous chlorine stations.
Okay. That's it for me, Mike.
Okay, thank you. Karen, did you have any questions?
Yeah, well, you know, acronyms are my favorite thing ever. What is a PLC card replacement for $30,000?
Yeah.
Chris, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, so the PLC is a programmable logic computer. It's the brains for all of our individual sites. So that particular one was end of life for Lost Canyon. The majority of that was all the hardware cost with a small bit of programming and time from SKM.
Okay, great. That's all I had questions on.
So it wasn't just the card, it was really replacing the whole PLC?
So we had actually upgraded the processor component several years ago. What was old was actually all the input cards, so you know, all the analog and digital inputs and outputs. Those cards were no longer being made, and if we'd had to replace one, you know, if we had a failure, we couldn't find a replacement. So that, you know, that portion was end of life. We had to put in all new cards for current model stuff that we can get replacement parts for.
for all the I/O.
Yep. Yeah, and the cards we took out were the original ones from when that was built.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, good. That was a good question there. Let's see, Tim, did you have any questions on the check register?
Yeah, what's a card?
Still,
Chris, are you going to feel that?
Yeah, I couldn't get my unmuted. Hang on. I wish I had a picture I could share with you.
When I think of a card, I think of like a deck of cards. Something that you might take out of your wallet and allow you access to get into a place or something like that. I think you're using card in a different...
Yes, it's a much, much different term. Hang on one second. I'm going to try and...
I mean, I'm the only one that doesn't know what you're talking about, so that's why I'm asking.
Bear with me just one second.
Is it like a processing component that you put into, is it like a chip, only it's a card?
So all the wires for all these sensors and everything that are spread out all through the, through the facilities all have to come back to one central location. And so all these physical wires, so, you know, from flow meters, from pressure switches, from pressure gauges, all that stuff has to come back and land, physically be terminated somewhere. And that's the parts that we replaced. And unfortunately, I was looking for a picture I have, and I don't see.
No, it's okay. I had to understand what a card is, because we were using it quite a bit there about how they had to get replaced and stuff. So it's a component that goes into a processor or something that collects data.
Okay. Yep. Let me just see if I can find really quickly.
I almost think of it, Chris, with like a big switchboard that now you have to replace it so all the things that come into it will process still, right?
Yeah. So this, can you guys still see my screen?
Remember, I'm so old that card used to mean punch card.
Yeah. So can you guys see this image that just came up?
Yes.
So this is a portion of our PLC. This is the brain part. But each one of these individual slots is considered a card. So there's a main bus along the back of ours is like 5 times longer than this. And each one of these cards is replaceable. You literally just pull straight out on it. It has pins on the back, and it connects. And the inside of it, let's see.
So you have to just give them the specs, and then they make the card and send it to you, and you punch it in. Or does someone come out and do that?
No, we have to wire it in by hand. It was a full day of disconnecting every wire that came into that PLC and re-terminating it again.
Okay. Well, thanks. I mean, we don't have to go into. I just had to understand what that meant.
Yeah, I don't see a good example of it, but this is sort of what we're talking about. Nope, never mind.
Chris, sometime you can show Tim one of our cabinets. That can be fairly impressive.
All right, so I don't think there's any other questions on the check register. Do we have any purchase orders?
No purchase orders needing a board approval tonight.
Okay, can we get a motion on the consent agenda, please?
I move to approve the consent agenda.
I'll second.
Second, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Okay, that was unanimous. Moving on to item six, the financial update by Mr. Steve Anderson. Take it away.
All right. So did that come up okay? Okay, sorry. So right now we're about $1.1 million ahead of budget. That is a combination of being $900,000 better on revenue and about $200,000 lower on expenses. As we dig into that revenue increase, the second where I've got the line highlighted in yellow. So that $900,000 revenue spike we're seeing or increase above budget, $745,000 is from development-related collections. So this is impact fees, assessments, meter connections, things like that. And that's just where we've had this, I guess what intuitively we would have thought COVID would have hampered the economics, but in Park City, it's given it us a boom. So that's what the big variance is. There is a little bit of a variance in water, the $150,000, but that's what's really causing the big variance in revenue so far this year. On the expense side, we're running below budget right now, mainly through operations, maintenance, and repairs. So we'll have to just see if that continues through the year. Last year, as you may recall, distribution was really expensive. We had the additional regional review and regionalization fee, plus a lot of repairs last year. But this year, we're doing a lot of repairs too, but we'll see how that budget holds through the year. But expenses are looking fine. Cash, just to draw your attention to a couple of things on this. So you'll notice there was a pretty large increase in the operating cash reserves, and that mainly came from the capital facility reserves. We were able to transfer some of the projects that were capital facility funded last year. We were able to transfer those funds over, so that adds to basically cash that was restricted is now we can use anyway. So you kind of see a movement from this fifth line down, capital facility reserves went down, but our operating reserves went up. We are at 348 days of reserves right now, so we're in really good shape on cash. The other line I wanted to point out to you is under regionalization reserves, this $2.56 million. That is the fund we've set aside to prepay debt and for our drought contingency and things like that. So when we talk about the debt we're going to be paying off with Zions, the funds will be coming out of that regionalization reserve.
Steve, is there any, I know in our policies when we get to 365 days of cash reserves, I believe there's a decision or action point. Is that correct? And if so, is that just handled as part of the budget cycle, or does that need to be done in real time?
I believe it's more at year end, isn't it, Lisa? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the exact policy. I know the policy you're talking about, but I don't know how quickly we have to react to that.
I think we'll have to have a discussion fairly quickly, but if we decide to take the money talking about from Zions and take it out of our regular operating reserves, that would bring that balance. So we wouldn't hit the 365. So I wouldn't, even though we typically kind of said we were going to prepay debt with the regionalization reserves, because our cash balance is so high, days cash on hand, in that unrestricted operating account, I would consider taking it out of there so that we're not running up against the 365. At least, right, we will revisit it during the budget, but it won't force our hand earlier than that.
Okay, thanks.
That's a good, thank you, Lisa.
Well, Steve, where do we hold the drought reserve? Is this not the sheet that this would show it?
We haven't broken those funds out yet. They will come out of one of these other reserves, this regionalization reserve, when we allocate those funds. We've talked about setting it up, but we haven't broken those out as a separate fund yet.
Yeah. The fund.
It's hard to assess the amount, isn't it?
Oh. Well,
from what our discussion and the way we structured our policy is that we would fund our drought reserve as part of our budget discussions, our annual budget discussions. So when we get closer to, we're starting to work on the budget next week for 20, or next month, excuse me, for 2022. But that's when we would come to you with a suggestion for how much we would want to fund in that reserve, and then we'll start breaking it out separately.
Okay.
All right.
So, I'm sorry, on the capital facilities reserves, it dropped by about $500,000.
Yeah.
From the previous month.
Yeah, there were several projects we completed. The state has a fund that we have to put 5% of our operating budget into each year for capital facility reserve, as a capital facility reserve to make sure we'll keep our funds up, our facilities up. When we complete a project, we submit to the state, hey, can we pull the funds out of that account and just into our operating account? We basically paid for them, and now we're just saying, hey, could we get reimbursed out of our own reserve fund? And so they were completed at the end of 2020. By the time you give the 30 days notice and everything gets finalized, that's why the funds didn't move until April.
We identify which projects are going to be, we're going to take that, to use that reserve from when we do the capital budget every year. So this year, last year's budget, we had identified some of the line work that needed to be repaired was from that budget. So you generally see how much we're going to be using out of those reserves when we do the annual capital budget.
So we spent that $491, or where did it go?
It basically went from that that account up to the operating cash and reserves, the top line. I mean, there's obviously other movement, but that's the biggest. That's what caused that change, the increase in operating cash and reserves and the decrease in capital facility reserves. Basically, we were able to reclassify that as funds or move that so it's funds we can use on anything, just not on capital facility.
We had already spent those funds and paid those vendors, so we were just essentially reimbursing ourselves out of that fund back to our unrestricted accounts.
Operating cash.
Okay. Yeah.
I got that. Thank you.
You bet. Let's go down and talk about that customer growth. So through April, we've had 152 new water connections. So this is somebody who's come in and paid their deposit, their meter connection fee, and their impact fee, or used prepaids to pay their impact fee. So it's not necessarily a new water user at the moment, but we count them as new water connections. Of those 152, first of all, 152, the average through April is 33 over the last 4 years. So you can see the crazy growth we're going through right now. And then I've given you kind of the breakdown by areas. You know, 82 are in Silver Creek, 31 in Promontory, 23 in that Discovery Summit Park area, 10, I guess, along the North Ridge, if we'd want to call it that, 5 in the Colony, and then 1 in Silver Springs. So our impact fees for the year so far are up to $485,000. We had budgeted $600,000. Yes, we are going to go well past that. So it just was unfortunate. I mean, I think Karen gave us a little clue. Like, I think this is going to be better than you think. I think it's even going to be crazy better than we think. What was that, Karen?
I didn't want to say I told you so, but
I tried to beat you to it. So, but yeah, it's going to be a really big impact fee year. In Promontory, the lots that have sold up there have already sold 43. I believe right now it's usually only 8 for the year. So get ready for a lot of new neighbors too, Karen.
You know, they just dropped off construction materials at the lot next to me and the one past it. So now I won't be able to see the well as well.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I'm just impressed they were able to get
Did they put an armed guard next to it?
Yeah. There you go. Water usage. April this year was, for our MRW customers, was slightly higher than last year. For the year to date, we're just a little bit below last year. But, you know, May is really when we start to see the usage start to tick up and really start to be able to gauge how much customers are going to use through the year.
The other big change to point out is Park City. Last year, as you may recall, they didn't take any water in March and April. So their usage or how much they're taking so far this year is significantly higher. But, you know, we have planned for that and kind of expecting it. And it is actually very consistent over the 4 months so far.
Summit's taking water too.
What was that?
Summit's.
Yeah, Summit's has their 1,100 acre feet. Again, this year, they've already taken 416 of that so far this year. So,
and they're on the same schedule as they were last year. So those numbers, as we compare to last year, should be consistent.
Yeah. They're a little higher this year, I think, than they were last year at this point. But I think they watch that real close. They shut it off right as they hit 1,100 on December 31st, it seems. So, all right. Capital budget. You'll see a lot more movement in this in the next couple of months as all these projects that we've got scheduled for this year start up, including the Spring Creek. We'll be getting that going hopefully here real quick and some other things. We did receive one truck, but it's in getting its flatbed installed and lights and things like that because it's a big, more of a, not just a passenger truck, it's more of a big work truck with a big flatbed on it. So that one will probably be delivered first. We're still waiting on the other one as Ford is having their own manufacturing issues, it sounds like. Right. Just the graph, a little bit about the water sales. As you can see, they've been really flat basically the last 3 months, and May is where we really start to see the indicator. The green line was last year, where, as you may recall, we had that really early hot spring, so usage really was high for May. It'll be interesting to see where we come in this next month, whether we get that same spike or whether we land up somewhere in between those three dots for May. So you can see the water starts flowing here right now. So, all right. This was just a little snapshot at the April, where we were a little bit, April budget, April actual, we were a little bit over on residential sales, but pretty much in within what would be expected levels. So that's kind of it for that part, unless there's any questions on that.
Looks pretty good.
All right.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
You bet. I think, Sam, are you going to go next with the talk about the contract, I think, for...
Yeah, let's just have Mike tee up the next agenda item, and then Sam can jump in.
So I've got the next one is human resources.
So we had an amended agenda that came out yesterday, Mike, that I think was sent out via email. So 6B is now consideration of approval to award construction contract for the Kilby Waterline to Newman Construction in the amount of $289,000.
Okay. So do you guys want to, Sam, are you going to give us a little background on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the water line along Kilby Road, which is the frontage road to I-80 between Jeremy Ranch and Summit Park, more or less, was identified as the priority waterline project for this year, and kind of based off field experience with waterline leaks in the past and known corrosion issues with the soil. So the entirety of the alignment was surveyed and designed all the way from the roundabout up to our booster pump station, which is kind of in front of Woodward. Well, that's about 4,000 linear feet. And in addition, this time we brought in a corrosion specialist to complete a condition assessment of the existing waterline, which is new for the district. And that included a visual evaluation of the pipe condition, some thickness testing, and then analysis of some soil samples. And after excavating a number of pits along the alignment, we decided that a portion of the waterline would not need immediate replacement, which is a positive thing, saving some cost for the district. So all those were rolled into a new plan set, which was designed and successfully bid this spring. And I can share my screen here. Give me a thumbs up if you can see that. Okay. Thank you. And ultimately resulted in a recommendation for award from our civil engineering consultant, EDM Partners, this the 19th of May, just recently. I'm actually pretty happy with how the pricing came in. $289,000 for about 3,400 linear feet of water line. That is, I don't know, $85 a foot, plus or minus, which is considerably more than prices we saw last year for our waterline projects, maybe 15-20% more. But given what material prices currently are for PVC and where we're at in the entire construction industry, I was a little scared where things were going to end up. So $289, I think we got decent pricing.
Sam, what's the diameter?
It's an 8-inch.
And how many feet?
3,400 above, I believe.
For $289?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have we done work with Newman Construction?
Brian, can you chime in on that?
No, we've never used those guys as a contractor.
Because when you take a look at the bid tabs, I think the engineer's estimate was somewhere, started with a 4, I think. And when you go through the bid tab on there, the 800-pound gorilla that runs the pipe, right? And when you take a look at the pipeline cost without the administration and all the other stuff on there, it looked to me like Newman Construction might have missed something, in my opinion. But, I mean, how are they able to get that pipe installed for half the price of what our engineer's estimate was? I mean, what is the bid evaluation from EDM Partners? What are they doing with regards to the bid evaluation? Are they saying that all the paperwork was in?
Yeah, for the most part, that's correct.
Oh, no, go ahead, Scott. Sorry.
I was just going to say, the primary component of EDM's review is to make sure that all the checking all the boxes on the paperwork that came in to make sure it was a compliant bid.
Tim and I kind of had the same thought, and then as I was looking through their bid and their references, they've actually done quite a few projects and larger projects. So it comforted me a little bit. They did a lot of the work down in Daybreak with South Jordan. That was a contract for $3.6 million where they, you know, installed, you know, 2,300 linear feet of 20-inch pipe and then another 1,128 linear feet of 8-inch pipe. So I was impressed as I was going through their bid how much pipe they've laid already just recently in that they included with their packet. So I think we're getting something like we've done this before.
It looked like it was way under what our estimate was, and I mean, it didn't look as though Beck Construction was interested. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I think it's a good point, Tim. I think it was the pricing was much lower than what we were anticipating, as Sam said. I think there's maybe some comfort in the fact that this, in theory, is not a very complicated project. It's a waterline install, largely out of pavement. So in theory, there's not a ton of complexity, which is on our side. Certainly not nearly as complex as the Hidden Creek project that Sam's wrapping up.
Okay, well, it's a tough bidding environment these days, I know.
I think there's some value in Tempest's number as well, because they've done a ton of work around the Summit Park area. and along Parley's recently. So the fact that their bid was just a bit above Newman's, to me, indicates Newman actually had a pretty accurate bid.
Well, I think our engineer's estimate, maybe that was done by EDM or something. I'm not sure who did the engineers, but yeah. It was well above 400,000.
Yeah. I think, Sam, if you scroll down.
That was conservative, certainly, Tim. Yeah. I mean, we really didn't know what to expect with material pricing being the main issue, and for lead times in excess of 30, 60 days for PVC right now. And I think, yeah, the engineer's estimate was conservative reflecting that.
That's the only comment that I had on there. If you guys are comfortable with it, let's do it.
Okay. So, Sam, do you need a motion to move forward, or is this just for the board's information?
I believe this needs a motion, right, Scott?
Yeah, that's correct. We need a motion. So if the motion needs to be, if it helps you, Mike, I can just read it off here. Consideration. It'd be a motion to approve notice of award for the construction contract for the Kilby Waterline to Newman Construction in the amount of $289,000.
So moved.
It'd be a motion to have you sign that notice of award.
Correct.
Okay. There.
And I second it.
Okay, so who made the... Somebody needs to make the motion.
Ian.
I so moved it.
Okay. And then Tim was the second. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Thanks, Sam.
Sure. Yeah, appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for joining us tonight, Sam. Back to parental leave.
Yeah, night, guys. I'm going to take off more early. Nice seeing everybody.
Good night, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, now we've got item 7. Human Resources, Lisa Hoffman, talking about a new job description for energy and technology.
Sorry, Mike, we got another amendment that came in again as part of the amended agenda last night. So 6C is another finance-related item. It's an update on the prepayment of debts held by Zions Bank. Debts to be prepaid are a 2014 property lease in the amount of $228,642 and a 2017 equipment lease in the amount of $320,012. And Park City will share in their proportional amount as debts are related to Lost Canyon.
What kind of equipment lease is that?
It was basically a purchase lease of the three generators that we installed all at the same time back then. So they financed those through Zions.
Where is the property?
It's Lost Canyon. It's the backup generators for Lost Canyon.
Chris, should I share my screen again? Is that okay, Scott?
Chris? Go for it. Yeah.
So we've been contemplating paying these debts off, and then Park City also came to us because this is calculated into their monthly base bill, their portion of it. So they said, hey, we'd like to pay this off. How do you guys feel about it? We're like, yeah, that sounds good. We've been thinking about it ourselves. So the generator lease was originally $373,000. The payoff for June 15th is $320,000. So we get our 56% of that, so $179,000. Park City pays $140,000 to pay off the generators. Then the other lease was for the Lost Canyon office and property. And there was a portion that we just took on ourselves. That was for the land, actually. And so that payoff on that amount is the $135,000 that we just have to pay ourselves. Then there was the portion shared with Park City was actually for the building down there, the old home that we kind of remodeled and did. And that was $126,000. So the original lease was $310,000. So we'll pay on that portion. The payoff's $93,000. We pay $52,000 and Park City $40,000. So we're going to prepay $548,000 of debt that sits on our books. We're going to come up with the $367,000. We'll probably pay it all, and then Park City will reimburse us the $181,414. For us, this will save us about between $850 and $900 of interest a year over, 15 years. And then,
can you tell them what the interest rates at are on both of these?
They were 3.27 to 3.5 on these. So that's part of Park City. I think they are able to, they're doing some refinancing at a lower rate than these right now. For Park City, it will drop how much they pay us every month by the $1,010 because these were the two components that were built into their monthly base that they would pay principal and interest. So just wanted to make sure. I talked to Dave, and I believe Dave's, or I shouldn't say talked, emailed with Dave about this. He says we didn't need council approval, but we just wanted to make sure the board was aware of our plan to prepay this debt. Any questions on that?
Yeah, Steve, I'm not understanding who owns the property. Who owns the property that we're paying the lease to?
We own the property. Sorry, Scott, did you want to?
You got it, Steve, go for it.
We own the property. Basically, the $126,000 was to get the building and office up to, so it would be functional as an office to run Lost Canyon. So that's the portion that I think back in the day they decided was appropriate to allocate, that we would have to share the cost in that office.
But I'm having a hard time understanding the term lease here. Sorry about this. Is it?
It was just a mechanism. It's really just a lease to buy, if you want to look at it that way. It could have been just phrased as a loan, but the way it was set up, it was Zions classified it as a lease.
So we're opting to buy here in this case.
We would have owned it at the end of the lease anyway. Now we're just going to own it sooner.
It's basically a form of a mortgage, if you will, right? Steve, we borrowed money from Zions Bank. It's a different financing mechanism than going out and getting a mortgage. And we're paying that back, and now we're prepaying it in full. But the property's in Mountain Regional's name.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott.
So at the end of this, the property is going to be owned jointly by Mountain Regional and Park City?
No, they were only asked to pay for the remodel of the building down there that made that operational as an office, as I looked into the details of that a little bit more. And that kind of makes sense. That remodel will keep that functioning as an office for a long time, and that was just the cost of remodeling and getting that up to where we could use as an office. So that's where, that was kind of more of an expense, but we will own the property and the building at the end of it. I didn't see anywhere where they own any of that after the fact in the agreement.
They don't. I mean, it, I realize it gets confusing, but in municipal bond law, there is a specific, it's a fictional device, basically, where you can lease back to yourself stuff so that your lease payments go against the bond. It's called a lease revenue bond. And by doing that, you don't have to have a GO bond that you have to go out to the voters of your district. It's simply a municipal bonding device. And Mountain Regional has always owned the asset and still owns the asset.
Yeah, and I've got the parcel map up right now. We're the owner. There's no joint tenant with Park City.
So is this going to end up being it's just going to net out where now our assets are going to grow by this amount.
I think
we're doing this early payment.
No, our assets already show this, and we've been depreciating.
What it will do is it'll just drop our debt, our liability.
Okay.
All right.
The other question I'd ask Dave that you kind of responded to was just about the liens on that we send to the county. So maybe in your section, if you could just speak to that a little bit. I don't know if you've learned more or what I should kind of plan, but yeah, this was Dave said just needed to present it to the board, didn't need to take this to council, so on the debt payment. All right. Any other questions about this?
No, I think that's clear that it's just information that we're paying some of this debt off a little early.
And given our cash position and the interest rate on this, it makes a lot of sense to do it. It'll save us money in the long run. Not as much as the bond refinancing saved us, but it still saves us money. So
maybe $1,000 a year for 15 years or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, that was more $800 a month, for at least the next couple of years when the interest payments were still high.
Okay, so that's that's $150,000. All right. So I don't think we need any action there.
No motion there, Mike, and just to kind of head it off at the pass so that you understand where we're going here. Chris, maybe you can put the agenda back up. Steve, you could stop screen sharing. Lisa's going to go next with a HR item, and then we remove the Pine Meadows annexation fee discussion from the agenda. So we're going to move from Lisa straight into the general manager comments.
Okay.
Okay, so in your packet, I had a job description for an energy and technology technician. This would be in Chris's department, in the ATM department. So as we've been talking about, we had an open position at the treatment plant because of Leo Williams' retirement. That was filled internally by Eric Malling from Chris's department. So he has been transferred up there. So now we have a vacant position in Chris's department. We were reviewing the job description, which Eric was operating under for some time, and wanted to make some changes to have it more accurately reflect the job responsibilities that this position will be taking on, especially in light of the fact that we just recently hired Caden Baird, our new GPS and GIS administrator. So Chris went through and updated description. It will largely kind of be an assistant to Chris to help him with SCADA. This person will help with reviews and preparation of impact fees, also assist Chris with IT and office technology, computer setup type stuff. We sent it to Summit County's personnel director, David Warnock. He approved it, didn't have any changes. So we will, if it's approved, we just need your approval to get this job description going. It's not really adding, it's like I mentioned, it's not adding a new position. It's just better describing our needs in Chris's department. This used to be titled the GIS technician position, and it really wasn't the right description of what we need. So, again, we updated it. Doesn't change the headcount. We will post it internally if approved for 7 days. If we don't get any internal interest, then we will go to the market to look for somebody the end of next week. Any questions? Or do you have anything to add, Chris?
Nope, that was perfect.
Okay.
So, Lisa, you're saying it has zero effect on the budget without adding a new position?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay, so do we need a motion to approve this, the job description?
Motion to approve the energy and technology technician job description as written.
Okay.
Just a second.
I think I was the only one. So do we need some more discussion?
Sorry, I missed that, Mike, when you asked for the vote.
Yeah, I did too.
Oh, okay. So all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay. That was unanimous. Item 8, some general manager comments.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. So agenda item 8A is a district office update. This is just a brief update on the efforts towards a new district office facility. One of the things that came out of the leadership meeting that we held with chair and vice chair of our board, chair and vice chair of council, Tom Fisher and myself, was a recommendation for Mountain Regional to work directly with the county in the master planning process that they are working through. I later learned that the special service districts were named in the RFP that the county sent out for a group of consultants, which include a civil land planner and architect consultant team. That team has been selected, and there is a scoping meeting tomorrow, which I've been invited to. So the idea here is Mountain Regional will provide the outputs from our internal work sessions on the spaces that we envision in this new facility. And then these consultants will help us to understand the size of the facility that will be needed to accommodate those, as well as the size of the parcel that will be needed to accommodate the facility. And then they can essentially, you know, incorporate this directly into their master planning process to identify location of parcel, ingress, egress, et cetera. That process was recommended so that we could avoid any inefficiencies through the handoff process. If we were to hire our own team and say, okay, this is what we need, and hand it off to the county's team, and they say, well, this is a square peg in a round hole. So, you know, I think this is going to be much more efficient, much easier for the district. So again, I'll be attending that scoping meeting tomorrow. And we did hold those internal work sessions, with the operations team. We invited the entire team to that meeting, and we had a separate administrative team meeting where we talked through the spaces that we needed. And so I feel to date that we've had a really robust process, and I'm hopeful that the information we provide will help get some good direction as we go forward. The master planning process and the plat, the subdivision plat design process is expected to occur during this calendar year and conclude later this year. Are there any questions on that?
Yeah, Scott, I have a question. Is what they're doing in this RFP, from Mountain Regional, is it going to be identifying where our facility should be located within this property and how large it should be?
That's correct, Tim.
But when it gets to the property lines, then Mountain Regional gets to take over and decide how to design the facilities within that property?
That's also correct. So we'll have a decision point to make whether or not we want to hire our own team through likely a statement of qualifications, procurement process, or to work directly with this same team with the county who they've hired to design. I believe at least one facility has been named on their end already. We'll have the opportunity to potentially work with that team, but we'll have to work with Dave on getting that contract amended and making sure that we're following all our procurement policies on that.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, hearing none, on to other, I have a number of topics so that I could touch on. I'm gonna touch on a handful of them, but very briefly. If any board members have any questions or want me to go into more detail on any of these, please just speak up. I made a last minute decision this week to head down to St. George to attend the Water Users Workshop. This is a conference that's held annually. Of greatest interest to me this week was to get an update on the water supply conditions. Quite simply, they're poor. They're really about as bad as they've ever been in the historical record. What does that mean for the district? You know, we're working closely with Weber Basin. We're supporting them and pushing out all of the communication with our customers on the recommended watering cutbacks of 20% of your outdoor usage. And Brian and I met today to talk about where our sources are at and some operational thoughts and strategies there. Obviously, we're going to be watching our groundwater conditions very closely. At the moment, they appear to be in good shape. But that's where we're at. It's just a brief update that this really is one of the worst water supply conditions in the historical record. And it's 2020 was the driest year on record going back to the late 1800s. So pretty significant, it's an interesting time. You know, I think it'll stay tuned, and I think there's going to be a lot of information, on the media waves as we go forward. On PR efforts, Lisa and Anna have been doing an awesome job of trying to push this message of watering reductions. They have a number of efforts that are going on. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just want to commend them and all the work that they're doing. And I think really leaning in, the district's leaning in more so than ever before on water conservation and trying to, support Weber Basin, support us, and try to, help do our part and, alleviating the conditions as best we can. We had our leadership meeting, which I mentioned just a few moments ago. The topics that were discussed were the Pine Meadows annexation, the future large importation project, and kind of what are the initial steps to getting that to the point of being a shovel-ready project when the need is here. We talked about the Mountain Regional's office needs and planning, and we provided a drought update. Similar story with the conditions that we just talked about. Mike or Karen, do either of you have any takeaways from that meeting that you want to share this evening?
Well, it was interesting that they seemed to think they could tap into some federal grants with the infrastructure plan of Biden's out there. So I suppose if that's true, that could be helpful.
Yep. Yeah. What we talked about is identifying a project, like I said, making it shovel ready. So for one of two conditions to happen, one is these federal grants or federal subsidies, if they amount to something where it makes sense for us to move forward sooner rather than later, then that's a consideration. Secondly, when the supply and demand balance hits a point where demands are such where a new project's needed, we'll be ready to go. So So thanks for that, Karen. Mike, anything from you?
No, I think that's, that pretty much covers it.
Okay. Next item is we continue to gain traction on the wildfire mitigation work and really the organization of the group that I've been involved with. The group has officially been named the Weber River Watershed Coalition. We are applying for a $300,000 grant in June to support the hiring of a full-time staffer at Summit County as a public lands coordinator who will help to really manage this project and other projects. That money will also be used for really supporting all the parties involved to perform the discovery on where additional funding can come from, to work through all the public relations that's going to be needed to perform this mitigation work across many jurisdictions, including federal lands, state lands, and private lands, and some other items as well. Other funding sources, Weber Basin has stepped up and pledged $50,000 this year to the effort. We've been talking with Utah Shared Stewardship Group. They have dollars that are up for approval tomorrow. As they said, they're shaking the couch cushions, and the update I got down at the Water Users Workshop was that was fruitful to some extent. I think the numbers will be similar to Weber Basin's contribution. Mountain Regional and the other beneficiaries of the water intake structure, Park City, Summit Water, and Weber Basin, have each contributed $3,000 to help to fund Utah State's research that's tying into the project location identification and the types of mitigation work that they believe would be fruitful. They'll be working directly with the Forest Service on that. And as we look forward, the shared stewardship group is very supportive that some much larger funding could be available for us in 2022 for this group. And the idea is not necessarily to fund the group, but to accelerate the pace of the mitigation work that the Forest Service is doing, right? And so said another way, the Forest Service has projects they'd like to accomplish, but there's significantly more work that needs to be done, again, crossing jurisdictional boundaries. So the idea is this funding would help support that work such that mitigation work could happen at an accelerated pace. So that's the quick update there. I do recommend that the district consider, as part of the budget process at the end of this year, identifying a line item in the budget that has funding to put towards this effort. So I think we can, I'll save the details of that for later this year. But I just want to plant the seed with the board that, I think it'd be appropriate for the district and all the beneficiaries of the intake structure to help promote this work.
Scott, when will we know what the specific mitigation measures are, and when are they anticipated to happen?
Good question, Ian. So Utah State, I expect to have data from Utah State this year, and that data will come in two forms. One is data which identifies the highest risk areas for debris flows in a post-fire precipitation event, which would impact the Weber River and thus have an impact on us pulling water out of the river. The second piece of information we expect to receive from them is an analysis of the types of mitigation work that could be performed in those areas, and based on their modeling, which types are recommended. I expect those pieces of information to some level of accuracy to be provided to the Forest Service this year. The Forest Service, my understanding is they are wrapping up Upper Provo mitigation work, I believe this year or over the next couple years, but in the near term, they are switching their focus and their dollars to the Upper Weber. So I think the Upper Weber work Some work has already been done in the upper Weaver, but it will be again in more earnest, I believe, starting in 2022. So that's where this shared stewardship money and also the Watershed Restoration Initiative, WRI, as some folks may have heard in the past. You know, between the two, we're hoping for seven-figure levels for grant monies to be applied to these projects. So both of those groups, well, shared stewardship, we've had direct contact with Laura Ault, who's leading that effort, and she's very excited about the coordination that we've already done with bringing in a number of important stakeholders, and basically said that this is exactly what they're looking for in projects to support.
But it sounds like the majority work will really happen in 2022. So we're just kind of hoping there's not a big fire this year.
Yes, that's correct. So, and really, I would say just starting in 2022, Ian, the reality is that, you know, I think the Forest Service really thinks on sort of decadal scales. So this would be ongoing work that would take many, many years to complete. But you're right. There's, as we look at this year, that this fire year is shaping up to be the wildland fire conditions are shaping up to be extremely, you know, dangerous this year. And there's not a whole lot we can do to get out ahead of that. Any questions on that? Otherwise, just a couple last items here. Just a heads up, I provided a package of information that was submitted to the health department as part of our concurrency report this year. That information is in your packet. Please feel free to review that at your convenience. Happy to field any questions either now or feel free to give me a phone call if you have questions at a later time. Lastly, the America's Water Infrastructure Act of 2018, as a reminder, the risk and resilience assessment was due at the end of June. We worked through a checklist, essentially, that the EPA had put together as a means to work through this process. We worked through that internally, completed that. We completed some countermeasures or some action items to look at as a result of that. And I submitted our certification to complete that process and that requirement here this month. So that June 30th deadline, our requirement's been met on that. And that's all I have on my update. Again, if there's any questions on any of those, I'm happy to provide more details. Hearing none.
Great work, Scott. There's a lot going on.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Ian. We're hopping over here.
Okay. There's no other questions. What about the the monthly updates, you know, the staff updates.
Yep, so we're going to, that's item number 10, so let's move to 9. We've got,
there it is. I'm sorry. No, item 10, Dave Thomas with the legal update.
So, Dave, I teed this up for you. I was wondering if you could just give an update to, you know, to us, the staff and the board on where the county council is going with respect to public meetings, and what are some of the things that we need to do to prepare to getting back in person. As part of this, I'd like to have a discussion with the board, open it up for interest to get back in person, and whether or not that's a hybrid approach where some may join remotely and some may join in person, or where we're going. But I thought Dave could help us at least understand the landscape from the county's side.
Certainly. The county passed last night a resolution pertaining to at least the county and its planning commissions and other commissions that basically provides, one, you can have electronic meetings, but two, there is going to be a return to a hybrid type system. The public health orders that allows public meetings without an anchor location have now been repealed. So this is the last meeting that you'll have without an anchor location. You will need to have a anchor location in your June meeting. The question is, generally, when you have an anchor location, you generally have a quorum of the board at the anchor location. Others can join by electronic means if you want. You can continue to have electronic meeting going on at the same time so that individual members of the public can view the meeting, and if there's public input, they could raise their hand in the electronic Zoom meeting and be promoted, and so they could provide their input. The county's kind of going to that system. It's starting at its first June county council meeting will be with an anchor location, and I am anticipating probably a quorum of the county council being present. There may be some who attend electronically, but I think all of them are going to try to attend. And they're hybrid. They're going to allow participation from the public electronically. They will also allow staff members to attend electronically and provide reports and agenda items electronically. So that's kind of how the county is going. And like I said, it's going to start the 1st of June. I don't know if anyone has any other questions.
Are we going to, if we do meet at the anchor location, is there going to be an expectation that everyone's vaccinated? Or?
That's something for you all to kind of determine what you want to do. Either vaccinated or masked, I suppose.
Davis, does the county have any specific guidance on that they're using?
They're not. At this point in time, there is no mask order. They're allowing public in facilities without masks. They leave it up to employees to decide whether they're going to wear a mask or not. At this point, there is not specific guidance. There is no mask order.
Could we require masks?
Technically, you can't. You can't require masks, because the state statute took that away once the three thresholds were hit.
Yeah, it was my understanding that state facilities like our office right now, we can't require them. So we don't.
Yeah, so like I said, right now it's, you can wear them if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to.
What are the board's thoughts on getting back together? I mean, we're basically hearing what Dave has said. We need to have a quorum present, at our anchor location.
I have a quick question on that. Is that a new state guideline that a quorum has to be present at the anchor location? Because in our electronic meeting policy previously, in our administrative policies, it says the quorum could be formed with people who are on electronically.
It can. I think the old rules were that they recommended a quorum be present at the anchor location. I just think it's probably for purposes of avoiding any potential challenges, having a quorum at the anchor location would be, what I would recommend conservatively.
How many board members would be comfortable meeting in person? Maybe let's start there.
Dave, is the county going to have a physical distancing requirement for their meetings?
No, not that I know of. Hmm.
We can sit outside. It's nice. I'll buy you dinner.
I'm willing to come back to meetings in person, and I have been vaccinated. My book club met in person last night for the first time, and then you had some people on Zoom. So I think that part's going to be a little awkward for a while, but I think it'll be nice to see everybody in person.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had the same with Tim on that. I'd rather meet in person. I've been vaccinated.
I've been vaccinated. I mean, I have.
Yeah.
But I guess a little... maybe behind the times, we're still wearing masks at work, so I'm not quite as far on this transition maybe as everybody else is. I've had my vaccines.
I mean, just one thing to keep in mind too, the office is, the space is fairly small. It would be hard for all of us here to be able to, you know, if you're worried about distancing, it's going to be tough to keep the 6 feet between us.
Well, where is our anchor location going forward?
To be determined.
We moved it back here. Yeah, we moved it back here, but we could try to get Basin's room again, which is larger, now that our dates are on the same day. Our meetings are on different days.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we're
comfortable with that location over the Mountain Regional office.
You'd be comfortable there. Yeah, it's much more room. And if we didn't have everybody, and we could, you know, some of us of the staff could call in. But if we had a quorum of the board and maybe Scott, you know, maybe the rest of us, yeah. If that's more appropriate and feels comfortable for everyone.
Yeah, we're still doing wellness checks and temperature checks and, you know, three or four documents that you have to sign every day.
I would wear a mask if you wanted me to, Mike.
No, I think I'm just not used to it yet. I haven't got the transition going yet.
I'd probably wear a mask regardless of what others did.
You would?
Yeah. I'd be comfortable going back, but I'd wear a mask. And I would want physical spacing, at least for myself, where I choose to not attend in person.
Okay, so Scott, you want to work up some options of how you could, going back?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Mike. We can discuss internally, reach out to Basin Rec, try to understand the availability of their facility, and then provide some bulleted framework of how we can keep the risk to a minimum, you know, and still be able to conduct our meetings. And I can send that out to the board.
And Scott, you may want to talk to Ron Boyer at County IT.
Okay.
Because they're the ones that are in charge of the hybrid meetings at the county.
Okay.
And they will tell you how they're doing it.
I'll do that, Dave. Thanks.
Okay, anything else there, Dave?
I got a couple more for him, unless he has something else teed up.
Well, I think there was a question about the liens and whether or not the treasurer is going to disperse the full amount of the liens. No real update on that. I think the treasurer's position is the treasurer's position.
So what is the treasurer's position at this point? They're not... Help me understand exactly where we're at.
I think the treasurer's position are that the delinquencies become liens against the property, equivalent to the property tax liens, but that the county treasurer is not going to disperse ahead of a tax sale those funds to Mountain Regional.
I think that's problematic, Dave, because in all of our bond documents and disclosures, we've told our bondholders that we're reimbursed from the county at 100%. So we're going to have to amend our bonds, go to our bondholders, tell them that's no longer the case.
I mean, we could set up a meeting with Corey.
We need to.
With
Zions and our legal counsel with whatever his name is.
With Randy,
and let him know what kind of problems this creates.
Did when Steve talked to Corey, did Corey say anything else?
No, just kind of along those same lines, that's her expectation, that she would just reimburse as they receive funds, and kind of tried to do it last year, but then went ahead and paid us anyway. This year, we've been paid, but it was by accident. She accidentally sent us a payment that I've got to send back to net out to what they really owed us. You know, it's like $1,000 she overpaid, basically. And I'm like, okay, she wanted me to send the whole mistaken payment back, you know, $20,000 to $25,000. And I'm thinking, well, you owed us everything but $1,000 of that. And so that's kind of where our conversation ended. I didn't want to push it with her until we maybe knew all, you know, our position and how strong we needed to hold to the, you got to pay us, or we've got to have to do all this bond disclosure type of stuff. So,
I think as an initial step, we need to get together with Corey. I wouldn't necessarily suggest inviting everybody to it, but you know, a couple.
I would actually suggest that Steve and I contact Randy, our bond attorney, and get his input so that we know exactly what we need to do if she decides to push back.
Yep.
I'm not sure what's going on here and the
when we have customers who haven't paid their bill through the year, Mike,
right.
We can just turn it over to the county as a tax lien that they put on their property taxes.
Yep.
So basically we don't ever have bad debt. And as soon as we turned the liens over to the county, historically they had paid us what those liens were after the tax due date in the end of November. The last couple of years has become an issue of they don't want to pay us after taxes are due. They only want to pay us as they actually collect.
So it's kind of a new policy of theirs?
I don't know.
It's a new treasurer, it's my understanding.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a new policy, but it may be a new interpretation of how we are reimbursed for the liens we submit to the county for our customers.
We've got a new treasurer, and it's okay.
And I think we need to have that discussion. So, Lisa, I'm fine with that as an initial step to talk to Randy, though.
Steve and I can get on the phone with Randy and have a discussion and see what this is going to... You know, because we basically tell our bondholders that we don't have bad debt. Because, and we're not talking hundreds of thousands of dollars here. You know, we're talking a couple tens of thousands of dollars. But I want to know what the implications are, which I think they're rather large. Because we went out and did a bond sale, and we told all of them that we don't have any bad debt because the county pays us 100% for all the delinquencies.
Yeah. So let's have that conversation with Randy. Let's find out what it means. And then I think we need to meet with Corey and help her understand where we're at and if this is just something that, you know, a change that she would like to make. I think she needs to understand the implications of that change and try to work with her on continuing in the way that we've done it for quite some time, I believe.
Yeah.
All right. No, that sounds like a good plan. So thanks, everybody, for your input. And Dave, thanks for helping.
Can we go back really quick to the electronic meeting? I just want to be clear. It expired for us, so we need to do something before the next meeting, or we all have to meet in person. And so, Scott, are you going to come up with some ideas, and then we're going to form some kind of policy? Because I think with the county passing the resolution last night, it didn't fall. That obviously doesn't fall under the purview of special service districts. So we're going to have to adopt something into our administrative policies in order to address this new rule, right, Dave?
I mean, is it a new rule, or is it that, you know, we have the option to either fall back on the previous, you know, our previous electronic meetings policy? At least I know you reviewed that today. I haven't had a chance to do that yet. You know, is there an opportunity to fall back on those, or as a second course of action if we want to provide some other means of attendance for public and others? If we need to change that policy, then you're absolutely right. We're going to need to redline that. And something, Dave, that Lisa and I talked about today is, you know, when the county adopts these new policies, the telecommuting policy and the electronic meetings policy are perfect examples where Mountain Regional essentially adopts the exact same policy with minor grammatical changes. Is there any way that we could make a change to our bylaws or something to allow us, you know, give the board the authority to make these changes, maybe with inclusion of a legal review to show that there's no material differences from the county's policy? You know, these Mountain Regional going through the hoops to adopt the same policy is, you know, it's a significant use of everybody's time all the way up through the council.
Yeah, it's during our last go round with a number of these things, we talked to the council generally about these kinds of circumstances and the ability to alter the current governing ordinances of the special districts to allow some additional flexibility. So they're aware of it, but they haven't done anything to necessarily change it. I don't know that we need to change our electronic policy. I think you can default back to that policy that you already have that allows you to have electronic meetings. I guess the question is, when we go back to having an anchor location, I guess the question is are you going to have a majority of the board, a quorum, at the location or not? Are you going to do social distancing and have a facility that allows for social distancing? And are you going to have this hybrid electronic meeting to allow the public to attend electronically? If there's something that needs to be changed in our electronic policy, it's probably that.
The public attending.
Yeah, the ability of the public to attend electronically.
Yep.
Yeah, because it just speaks to board members right now. It doesn't talk to public or staff or anything like that.
And once you have the anchor location, you're going to have space in case members of the public want to come to the meeting and be at the anchor location.
But per the state's new policy that you can't require masks, you also can't require physical distancing, right? That's kind of a want. That's not a need.
Yeah, I mean, the statute, the way that the statute was done, there was a lot of things that were specific as to masks. But once the three thresholds were met, the social distancing went away too.
Yep.
Because now you no longer have any health orders.
So yeah, there's not a whole lot we can do. You know, really, it's if we want to offer the provision for the public to be able to attend electronically, then that might be a policy change, if I'm understanding things correctly. And if so, you know, that's going to be a couple month process, right? We need to have a red line copy of our policies in front of the board for the next board meeting, which would have to be then a recommendation to council, which the council meeting would follow. So with respect to the June meeting, and again, it's directly in line with my frustration, and you know, I'm sure the other districts have the same frustration with this process that we have to go through. Oftentimes we're behind, right? The policy was approved last night. You know, now we have to jump, we have to react quickly to try to get something in front of the board. We're automatically a month behind, and at times, some may argue, you know, this is a good example, it's problematic.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And like I said, it has been brought up to the council before.
Okay. So I think for now, you know, Lisa, I'll take a look at our electronic meetings policy. You and I can put our heads together. Again, you know, what I mentioned before was basically a bulletized framework that I can send out to the board for review for the precautions that we as a group agree to take. But some of those could be impacted by public attending the meeting, and we can't stop the public from attending the meeting.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, is we can't do our meetings electronically anymore. We got to have an anchor, and we really can't ask for masks or distancing or really anything.
Yep, and if there's provisions that we would like to add to our electronic meetings policy, we'll have those as red lines for the board at the June meeting. Any further discussion on that? If not, Dave, I've got one more question for you.
Okay.
As we internally here are beginning to work through this concept or the need for an annexation fee for the Pine Meadows Mutual Water Company.
Mm-hmm.
We are discussing options of what needs to be included in that fee. Per our rules and regulations, the annexation administrative fee is defined as the following. The district may charge an annexation administrative fee, which shall be commensurate with the workload, legal efforts required, engineering, and other analysis required for the proposed annexation. So one of the things that Lisa and I talked about today was two approaches. One is that all of these fees, including outside legal counsel, an engineering evaluation, financial services, you know, to look at rates, impact fees, those types of things, they could either all be included in the annexation fee. You know, we'd have to go out, go through requests for statements of qualifications for the engineering work would be a recommendation by me for us to follow that procedure. So in other words, a lot of legwork up front before we can really define these individual components to get to a fee that doesn't put the district at risk. The second approach would be to only include or basically focus on the administrative staff load and the cost to the district of that time. as the administrative fee. And then through the annexation agreement, Dave, that I believe you and I will be working together on, we define how these other costs will be paid. And we identify what some of those other costs are. Like, again, engineering evaluation, outside legal counsel for water right work, financial support, et cetera. Do you have a recommendation or any guidance on maybe how we can proceed, or are either option is either option on the table?
Part of our problem is that prior to the annexation agreement, you're going to need to have all these things done. So you should probably have them in terms of the fee up front. I think what you can do is you can say to whoever the applicant is, yeah, they're responsible for the administrative staff time. They're also responsible for paying for a legal consultant to do water rights work for the district for their annexation, and an engineering consultant to do the engineering work. And you leave it at that. And unfortunately, they're going to be responsible. They're going to understand they're going to be responsible for it. We will have to go out and bid it. And based upon that bid, we can tell the applicant how much it's going to cost. Unfortunately, it's just a time-consuming process when it's not just one of these, one-off annexations of a lot here and a lot there. When you're talking about annexing an entire system like we did in the canyons, it's going to be time-consuming and it's going to be expensive. And in that case, they did provide consultants both for legal and for engineering that we used.
Yeah. Dave, is another... sorry, Dave, didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I was just saying it's unfortunate. It's just kind of the way it's got to be. Otherwise, if they're paying it on the tail end, they could decide in the end after we do all of this that it's too expensive, we're not going to pay for it, but we've already incurred all the costs.
So is there an opportunity to put together an annexation fee agreement with them that identifies these pieces and a mechanism for invoicing and billing as another approach? Or do you feel as though we need to have hard numbers on all of these things before the fee can be rolled up, defined, and approved by the board?
I don't know that we need to have it, completely in stone. I think you can leave some in terms of the board approving the fee. The board can approve the fee, the administrative costs, and then just reference that you're going to have to pay for these consultants. And then at the beginning, when someone comes in and wants to make that application to annex, we could have a fee agreement up front with them. It's based upon the fact that we're requiring, these fees, and this is how we're going to play it out. Yeah, we can have something like that, certainly.
So just to make sure that you're fully up to speed, so Pine Meadows has provided written requests to annex. So we're, that has happened, right? That's the first trigger in our process, the bulleted process that you and I worked on. Mm-hmm. The next step is for the district to identify the annexation fee and for the board to approve it before we go any further. Based on the information that I have and rules and regulations and otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so I would, my preference, although it has its own issues, but my preference would be to have an annexation fee agreement with Pine Meadows that identifies these costs that they'll be responsible for, and that we bill them, you know, on a monthly basis or on a basis that works, you know, for us internally, to make sure that we're not stuck holding the bag.
What if they don't have any money?
Well, you know, then what we can do is we can keep track of all these costs, and it becomes a portion of their assessment.
Yeah. And I think that an administrative fee, I think the word study needs to go in here. The annexation, it's really a study fee, isn't it? It's an investigation. It's not, if you pay this fee, you're annexed in.
Well, you know, so what we've done internally to date, Mike, is, so I agree with you that there's a number of studies that occur, you know, specific to the engineering evaluation. It's a study of all aspects of their system, right? And what deficiencies there are and how they incorporate into ours, right? And what needs to be put in place so that we can provide safe drinking water. You know, but with respect to the administrative fee, internally we're working through a man hour roll up that is nearly completed, and we're at 1,000 hours. So you know, based on inputs from all the departments. So there's a significant load to district staff to support this process, and I think we as a team,
I understand that.
Okay. So the circling back on this, you know, this agreement concept, Dave, do you think that's workable? I think the concern from them is going to be that, you know, they're writing a blank check, and, or to Mike's point, if they can't afford it, you know, how do we deal with that? I think that's, we have a provision that folds it into the assessment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can probably do a fee agreement. The problem is if they aren't able to pay it, you may have some risk, because if they can't pay it and you just say, well, we'll roll it up into the fees at the end, if they don't annex your stuff, you're stuck with those fees for those consultants.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know they want to get annexed, but ultimately, even if we come up with a consultant or whatever, and they have to pay the bill, they're probably going to complain about the bill. Dave, is there a way to go about doing this where the responsibility for the study falls to them, and that we have the rights to go in and review and comment on their findings?
We could. I mean, that's similar to what we did with you know, Community Water. They had the consultant.
Yeah, I mean, if we have enough. Oh, excuse me, Dave. Go ahead.
No, that's kind of what we did with Community Water. They retained engineering consultants that did a lot of the work, presented it to us, and we reviewed it. They retained a law firm that took a lot of the laboring oar in terms of all the different contracts and things that had to be done, and you know, we kind of negotiated with them on those contracts, and but yeah, I mean they paid for all those on their own nickel,
and we could develop the scope of work that would be necessary to be in that findings or the study or whatever you want to call it, and then review the work that they're paying for on our nickel, and just really be charging them for what our time and materials is for just the review and comment on the study that they're performing.
But that
we could have somebody involved in the selection process for who they're going to ultimately pick. Like maybe Scott would jump in there, depending on what the category is. You know, maybe Steve would be involved in the selection of who they're going to pick. But they would ultimately hold the contract, and they would be paying the freight, and we'd be in more of a review and comment mode.
Yeah, I think we originally talked about that a little bit. I think they have an engineer who's familiar with their system, but there was some concern about that engineer and that firm doing this kind of infrastructure assessment. So we would want our district staff to be comfortable with the selection of the engineer that they made.
And I think the concern was maybe not
administrative.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead, Mike. I think the concern was not necessarily with a particular engineering consultant, but rather if that consultant's expertise didn't have expertise in master planning and those types of efforts, that could put the district in a position of risk. And that'd be my comment. To follow up on Tim's, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, Scott. I was just going to add in, with Community Water, if Mountain Regional had been overseeing those contracts, would we have not been holding the bag as much on that process?
Well, TCFC is the one who paid for all that stuff ahead of time.
Yeah, we weren't holding the bag.
Versus TCFC, I mean, just their initial costs, like Dave mentioned, with the legal fees and the engineering that they went out and did, it was close to $500,000. So this is what it can add up to over time for these kinds of services. I don't disagree that I think that shouldn't be our responsibility, and I don't want to be left holding the bag of that. And TCFC got left holding the bag of that for years until they were finally able to roll it into the assessment. But if this goes sideways and they don't annex, I don't want us to be on the hook for it. That, you know, that system should be on the hook for it. And it's my understanding, I thought they had some, I haven't looked at their financials and we haven't seen anything yet, but they say that they have some money in the bank and they knew that this day was coming. It, you know, that I don't know how liquid they are, but I completely agree that we need to keep the responsibility on there, and I just want to make sure that we're getting a good product, and I know Scott does too, so that we can make a determination.
Yeah, that's
right. I like Tim's thought of having them have to contract with us approving or being able to review the information that's being provided. Because then they're, also if they walk away, they have to pay the bill. We're just kind of in that, if we can do that as a review status and just approval level, but they've contracted with an engineering firm or attorney, and they're providing, you know, products to us that then we approve. Yep, that passes the snuff. Then they're the ones who are on the hook until, like Community Water, like Lisa was saying, until we actually annex in, and then, okay, we'll reimburse you those costs out of the assessment.
If you can do this for me, Scott, if you can list and email me the list of all the different kinds of studies and reports or feasibility studies, engineering and otherwise, that would be needed, and an idea of what needs to be in those, I can start crafting an annexation fee agreement that basically makes it so they have to get the consultant, pay the consultant, but we have to pre-approve who the consultant is, then they would, you know, do the information, and we would have to review and comment on it, and then they would pay administrative costs probably as it goes along, maybe monthly.
That sounds good, Dave. Yeah, my only concern about, and there's pros and cons to both approaches here. My only concern is that you know, when we do our review of that final report, if we have significant findings or significant concerns, how do we ensure that those concerns get addressed? Since the assessment fee will ultimately be based on the findings of that report.
Well, that's my concern, Scott, is that, you know, TCFC paid for that other study. So maybe when I said, did we get left hole in the bag, it wasn't necessarily paying for that work, but it seemed like there were some shortcomings with that study, and we had to do an excessive amount of extra time, like dealing with easements and some of those other issues that maybe if we had been managing the consultant that did that study, we wouldn't have fallen into those, you know, pitfalls. So I like the idea of us managing that work if possible and not having, you know, the annexer do that.
Well, Scott, is our discussion right now at the 10,000 foot level and we really need to be at the 30,000 foot level?
I don't understand why we can't just ask them how they're going to pay for it. I mean, whether it's some kind of, if in real estate, if the their property becomes more valuable by having water associated with it, you know, that either the HOA or somebody in that process should be able to generate money by doing that, and then they can say, we're going to get $10,000 per property that will go toward a fund that will pay this back.
I think that's right. I was kind of thinking the same thing, that we might just need to deal with these on an individual basis and kind of craft what we need to match rather than to, you know, try and figure out something that works for everything. I like Dave's idea of starting that agreement and, you know, see what comes out of it.
Yeah, at some point they've got to swallow the pill of, this is going to be a couple hundred thousand dollars probably. Are you guys, do you guys know that? And maybe, I don't know, Scott, maybe you've already had that conversation with them, but, and just see, do you still have an appetite for it, knowing you're going to have to pay that plus an assessment for whatever deficiencies we have to do?
Yeah, I mean, we've provided the list of all the things that need to get done. I think that that's pretty, you can read into that and understand that it's an expensive process. So I'll work with Dave, and we'll start crafting an annexation agreement. Annexation fee agreement, and we'll go from there.
The fee to study the annexation. Okay. Anything else?
That is it for me.
Dave, are there any updates that have touch points to Mountain Regional with respect to the hideout process, or is that... Okay.
No, we're in litigation.
Okay. Nobody's reached out to us to talk about water. Okay.
Okay. So that was... Okay, so that kind of got blended in there. Were we in... That was... Scott, those were your comments. Day, do we come back to?
I don't have any other comments, so.
Okay. I think we're ready for Tim. Questions on department updates. Tim, did you have any?
Yeah, I had a question about the operations line. I don't know if Brian's on or not, but there was a reference in something about Silver Springs pulling a well, and you saw some sort of bridge. I didn't understand the context of the word bridge.
Yeah, so we're pulling a well that has kind of been dormant for like 11 years or so. And so we had it videoed, and they got down to about where the pump was set, and they ran into some sort of layer of crust. You know, I call a bridge, and they couldn't break it with the camera, so it was just interesting to see that in there. So when they come back in the next few weeks to brush and bale, they're going to try to break through that. Hopefully, they don't quite know what it is.
Okay, so it's right. Something that was plugging the well, some physical plug at a higher level than you were expecting.
It was about where the pump was set.
Okay. All right, thanks.
How much deep does the well go below that bridge, Brian?
Quite a ways. You know, 700, you know, total for the hole, you know.
Is the bridge above the screen or is it in the casing?
Yeah, it's above the screen, unfortunately.
Huh. Are you going to do a video log after the bridge is taken out?
Yes.
Cool.
That was it for me, Mike.
Aaron, any questions on the department updates?
No, I just like the competing pictures of the picking process.
Okay. Ian, any questions on the department updates?
I had a pig question for Sam, but Brian could probably answer it. So we had outside support helping with the pig effort, but it sounds like we're going to do it ourselves from now on. So that went really well.
Yes. So we just wanted to do it once more, having the company that we bought the pigs from come out and assist us. And they brought their own equipment. We're considering buying our own equipment for next year. And or renting it. We just wanted to do it one more time with, you know, get a level of comfort. It went pretty well. Our guys, you know, got it down, getting the pig installed and firing it up. I think we learned a lot about what type of pig we want to use and what's the most effective. So it's a good learning experience this go around.
So are we going to put together like an SOP on that process and then potentially like a schedule of how often we'll do that per year?
Yeah, I think Sam wrote up a process already. We just need to tweak it.
And then how often do we anticipate? Was that once a year, twice a year?
Yeah, once a year.
Cool. All right. That's it for me. Thank you.
It looked really good. Looks like it's just really busy. Everybody's just really working and holding it together, and it looks good. So, well, if there's no other questions on that, I think that takes us to the end of our agenda tonight. Is there anything else, though, that we out there, Scott?
No, I think we did it. It was I was expecting this meeting to be short, and here we are past 2 hours again. So I think we covered it.
Okay. We'll stand adjourned at 8:18, and I'd like to thank everybody for all their hard work and patience and getting us through this. It's really good stuff.
Cool. Thanks, Mike. We appreciate all of the board members' time, for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll see you in June.
Yeah, that sounds great. We'll see you in June.
Yeah, I'd be looking forward to seeing everybody.
Yeah. All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Cheers.